From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. So what happens now? The Senate Republican health proposal, their party's years-long promise to ditch the Affordable Care Act, was torpedoed last night by Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Jerry Moran of Kansas, who said they'd vote against it. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made a Hail Mary pass, calling for a so-called clean Obamacare repeal. In other words, vote now to fully overturn Obamacare, but wait and then replace it in 2 years. But three Republican senators have already come out against that idea, which may be enough to kill it. So what about McConnell's other call for a bipartisan plan? President Trump tweeted, Dems will join in. Well, will they? And what would they do to fix what exists, Obamacare? Let's bring in Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, of course, vice presidential candidate with Hillary Clinton. Senator, the repeal vote is probably dead, but what did you think of it?
I think it's a disaster, Robin. I met this morning in my office with a young mom who had a five-year-old daughter who was born at 1 pound, 11 ounces and has had significant medical needs. They have private insurance, but they need Medicaid waiver and other services for young Charlie. If you do a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, that protects this family because she can't be turned away as a pre-existing condition. She can't be turned away because she's already exceeded her lifetime caps. So a repeal, the CBO has already said, just the straight-out repeal would cost 32 million people health insurance over the next 10 years and increase premiums. That's the disaster solution. But the solution is simple. It is so easy.
And what is that, if it's so simple? What is it?
Why not let the Health Committee, on which I serve, Health, Education, Labor, Pension, and the Finance Committee that deals with Medicaid and Medicare, why not just ask the committees to come up with improvements?
Well, and what would you do, Senator? The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, did expand coverage to the uninsured. It reduced some costs, but everyone agrees there are problems. So what do you think the biggest problem is, and what's this fix?
So here, I think the biggest problem right now, there's a number of things we need to improve. Individual insurance market. If you are buying insurance, not through an employer, but on the individual market, costs are going up pretty high. And then there are some parts of the country where you can't buy on the individual market easily. So,
well, insurers are leaving because they can't afford it.
In the individual market. They're still writing policies for companies, but in the individual market, they're leaving. So how do you deal with that? I've introduced a bill, and I've been waiting in my committee. I'm on the HELP committee. I've been waiting for an opportunity to have a hearing about this. My bill would reintroduce into the Affordable Care Act reinsurance, which is a backstop for high-cost claims. If there's a backstop for high-cost claims, then the insurance companies get some predictability, and then they can write their premiums at a lower level that's more the normal level for everybody instead of having to take account high-cost claims.
Well, this reinsurance is this idea of insuring the insurers. Alaska has a $64 million program that will help insurers cover the highest-cost cases. One Alaskan insurer, we're reading in Politico, has spent about a fourth of its claims money on just 37 patients.
Yep.
So this is
the
idea of not just reinsurance, but risk corridor payments supposed to compensate insurers who covered sicker patients. But what do you do with Republicans like Rand Paul, who deep-sixed the GOP plan, who don't want to spend this money?
Robin, if you're asking me what I could do that would get unanimous support, that's going to be a short discussion. But if you're asking, is there something that could get bipartisan support? Reinsurance is part of Medicare Part D. Reinsurance is part of other insurance programs like flood insurance and crop insurance. Reinsurance was part of the Affordable Care Act for the first 3 years. It's not really a subsidy to insurance companies. It's a way to bring premiums down. If you have reinsurance, the companies can write premiums at an affordable level. We think it could drop premiums by about 15%. I've introduced the reinsurance bill. I've been on the HELP committee since January, but thus far, we have not been able to have a hearing about either the House bill or the Senate bill, and Leader McConnell is trying to force a vote on the floor, either on this Senate bill or on a repeal strategy. Why not let the Health Committee and the Finance Committee take the system that we have and look for those bipartisan improvements? And I guarantee if we do that, we will find them. But it's been the refusal to allow that process to work that has got this thing so gummed up.
Look, you are one of the many voices saying you have to fix the exchanges first, support the insurers who are being asked to take on, you know, people with pre-existing conditions. And in supporting them, you'll be able to bring the premiums down. But what about the call by a number of your fellow Democrats for Medicare for all, some kind of single-payer option to buy health insurance through the government? That's the kind of language, though, that frightens a lot of Republicans. Is that a step too far?
Well, that's the kind of thing that we ought to be talking about in the committee. I favor what I call Medicare for everybody, not a mandate. You don't have to have, you know, buy Medicare if you'd rather buy from Anthem or, you know, or Aetna. But I think we ought to have a Medicare buy-in so that anybody who wants to can purchase that. And I'd love to put that idea on the table and talk with my colleagues about how it could work. I do think we need to stabilize the marketplace, because the Trump administration's message is we're not going to enforce the mandate, we're not going to make the cost-sharing payments, we want to let it collapse, has injected huge uncertainty into the marketplace. I think we should stabilize it. But then, yes, I'd love to have this conversation about the idea of a public option, which I call kind of Medicare for everybody. But we can improve this system today if they will just shelve the one-party-only jam-it-through-on-the-floor plan.
Senator Tim Kaine, the Democrat of Virginia, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Take care.
Well, now let's bring in Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. And let's listen here to President Trump in the Oval Office this afternoon on the failure of the GOP's health care overhaul. He says he's not going to own the collapse of Obamacare.
We're not going to own it. I'm not going to own it. I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. We'll let Obamacare fail, and then the Democrats are going to come to us and they're going to say, how do we fix it? How do we fix it? Or how do we come up with a new plan?
What do you make of that, Domenico?
Well, it's more of this pie in the sky idea that suddenly Democrats are going to come on board with a giant cudgel as opposed to trying to work with Democrats on finding fixes. You know, a lot of this is so much of politics. And really, Donald Trump was not looking to, he cast a very wide net as to who should be blamed for the health care bill's failure. But that net didn't seem to touch any piece of himself or the White House.
Well, what happens to his agenda now? I mean, is he worried about tax reform and other things that he wants to accomplish, since he wasn't able to get Republicans in the Senate to support a repeal and replace of the Obamacare bill?
Well, I think it's very difficult to see what happens with his agenda next. Clearly, this imperils his agenda. You have a faction of the Republican Party, two factions rather of the Republican Party, whether it's moderates or right-wing ideological conservatives, who are not afraid of either Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell. And Donald Trump does not have them on his team. They are willing, if they feel like this bill, whatever bill they come up with, is not what they want done, that they are willing to buck this president. And that can make for some major, major problems. We've already seen one Republican, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who would not say whether or not he would support Mitch McConnell as leader going forward. Mm. So the wheels on this look like they could be coming off.
And Mitch McConnell, by the way, has been said to be a master tactician. So this is a blow to him as well.
Absolutely. You know, he's a master tactician, a master of the rules of the Senate. But he's never been in a position where he's been in the majority and has had to govern. And any great leader is there to find a problem. You become a politician because there's a problem that you want to address. You find workable, constructive solutions to do that. What Mitch McConnell has been very good at for 8 years has been stopping the agenda of the other party. He's been able to do that through various machinations within the rules. He understands the rules quite well. Even what he tried to do today with the rules and trying to use the House bill as a vehicle to try to repeal Obamacare, a crafty maneuver, but not one that is yielding any kind of constructive results.
Let's listen here to the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, speaking this morning on the Senate floor.
The door to bipartisanship is open right now, not with repeal, but with an effort to improve the existing system. The door is right open right now. Republican leadership only needs to walk through it.
Domenico, do you see Democrats and Republicans getting together to work on some of the things in the Affordable Care Act that need to be fixed?
It certainly doesn't sound like it. That was not something that President Trump has floated. It's not something that Mitch McConnell has floated. They are the two people who would need to get something rolling to be able to work on fixes and repairs to Obamacare. You know, the big problem here overall is the fact that policy-wise, there aren't much more than two options to solve the healthcare issue within the country. You've either got a single-payer system that the government funds almost exclusively, or a hybrid market-based system, which is essentially what the Affordable Care Act, and it's one that the conservatives came up with through the Heritage Foundation in the mid-1990s, early 1990s, as an alternative to Hillary Care. So for them to say that they want to change the system, have something different, it's hard because this is what they proposed.
Just in the 30 seconds we have left, the House has just unveiled a 10-year budget plan, big increases in military spending, big cuts to social programs like food stamps and also some tax reform. Does it have any chance of passing?
Certainly has a chance of passing. You've got Republicans, again, controlling both chambers. But with Democrats on the other side being able to try to say that they want to stop anything that goes through, you know, they're going to have to use reconciliation or other machination to try to figure out how to do that. And that would only be temporary.
Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor for NPR. Domenico, thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a relatively new illness associated with heavy marijuana use that causes nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. It's called cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, and it's becoming more common in places where marijuana is legal. Dr. Kenan Hurd is a professor of emergency medicine and medical toxicology and pharmacology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He joins us on Skype. Dr. Hurd, describe this for us, cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome.
Well, cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome is something that's been recognized for probably 15 years now, but it's something that we're seeing more commonly in areas where marijuana use is becoming more frequent. Essentially, patients who use marijuana very frequently for long periods of time, usually at least 6 months, probably most of them have been using for several years, develop sort of intractable abdominal pain and vomiting that sort of comes and goes over the course of days to weeks. And it's really a quite miserable experience for them. And it's something that we're seeing more and more often here in Colorado.
And one of the things that helps is hot showers, right?
Some patients do report some relief with hot showers. I can't say that it's something that's universal, but certainly many people, you know, when you ask them, will say, is there anything you've done to try and make it better? And they'll say, yeah, it feels better if I take a shower or a bath. It's not, although I think it's something that gets discussed a lot, I can't say it's something that I'd say is universal.
But a lot of people are heading to the emergency room when they get the symptoms of this, right?
Well, I mean, we certainly see a fair number of patients. I think there are probably a much larger number of patients who sort of suffer through and never make it into the emergency room. But we, you know, here in Colorado at our institution, we probably see one or two people every day with symptoms that we believe are due to this.
And does stopping marijuana use stop the problem?
It does eventually. I think that's one of the problems that people struggle with, is that it's something that continues on or can continue on for several days or even a couple weeks after use stops. And it's not something that's necessarily related directly to use. You know, people don't necessarily use marijuana and then feel the symptoms, or even, you know, stop using marijuana and then feel the symptoms right away. They can kind of occur, you know, intermittently even when people are using. So it's not like something we'd see with, you know, withdrawal from something like an opioid. It's not clear exactly what triggers this. It is clear that people who stop using after a period of time do get better in the vast, vast majority of cases.
Well, you say it's not clear exactly what triggers it, but we know that it is associated with heavy use of marijuana, right?
Yeah, I guess I meant what would trigger a particular episode in a patient. I mean, we certainly have a lot of people who are using marijuana frequently on a daily basis and never develop this. So it's sort of a new problem that we're just starting to get our heads around.
So one of the things that we've heard is that in states where marijuana is now legal, they're starting to see much stronger strains of marijuana. Do you think that's related to this?
My impression is it is. You know, I always get asked, well, people have been using marijuana for years. How come this thing is just starting to come to the front? And my answer is that, you know, in Colorado, we're seeing much more potent strains of marijuana, and we're also, you know, seeing much more availability. You know, there certainly were people 20 years ago who had access to marijuana, but probably not to the extent that they could literally walk down to the corner store and buy as much as they wanted. So now we're seeing people with, you know, the ease of access and the very high THC content that are getting exposed to these very high levels of marijuana on a very frequent basis.
So what would you like to be done with this information now that we know that this exists? I mean, should there be restrictions on how potent the marijuana can be that's sold in Colorado?
I think that's sort of a different kind of debate. I think that our message is always that this can happen, and the people that we see who are suffering from this are miserable, and we've had patients who have had their kidneys shut down because they're so dehydrated from the vomiting and the abdominal pain by the time they get to us. If you're a heavy marijuana user and you're having these symptoms, you should see your medical provider. You certainly would want to be evaluated to make sure there was no other cause. But it is, when these people come in, they are very, very sick and really miserable. And we at least need to have a discussion about, this may be related to your marijuana use.
What is heavy use of marijuana, by the way?
We're seeing it in patients who are daily users, and again, for long periods of time.
Are you noticing any other problems as a result of heavy marijuana use?
Well, certainly the availability, whenever we talk about exposures in children, it's always related to the availability of the products. And especially it seems to be getting a little better in Colorado, but we see accidental exposures in children, where they will see a candy, a gummy candy that's marijuana infused, and they'll eat that and they'll come in, pretty sick. We've seen it accidental ingestions by adults. And then we continue to see, intermittently people who will come to Colorado who maybe aren't heavy marijuana users will try one of the higher potency, especially the edible products, and end up, in the emergency room after they have a very bad experience. They'll be becoming anxious, paranoid, those kinds of things.
That's Dr. Kenan Hurd, who's a professor of emergency medicine and medical toxicology and pharmacology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Dr. Hurd, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad I could help out.
Well, for decades, there have been young adults worried about bringing children into a world that already doesn't have enough for those already here. Now, with warnings of droughts, floods, superstorms, some of today's young adults are thinking twice. We're about to meet two couples who wondered whether they wanted to add to the 7 billion people on the planet. Ashley Ahern from Here Now contributor KUOW in Seattle has their stories.
Most millennials, according to a Pew report, 64% of us, acknowledge that the climate is changing and that we humans are at least partly to blame. And that's why Mary Finley and Travis Sherman aren't having children.
Tonka, calm down.
I'm going to give Tonka some cheese.
Tonka is a 100-pound American bulldog, and he's the only baby Mary and Travis want in their lives. Travis says his decision to go childless stems from his childhood. He grew up in Las Vegas, and he watched as the water level in nearby Lake Mead dropped over the years. After high school, he joined the Navy, and he started hearing people talk about resource scarcity and global unrest tied to water shortages.
I'm fearful of the world that we are making for ourselves. I don't see us trying to change on a large scale, and so I don't see it getting better, and that's why I don't want to have a child.
Mary grew up poor in rural Washington State. She married her high school sweetheart at 19 and figured they'd have a few kids. But then she decided to go back to school.
And now I'm 30 and I'm like, I definitely don't want children.
What Mary does want is a PhD in psychology. She knows that having kids wouldn't make that impossible, but it would definitely make it harder. She's also really concerned about how much we humans are taking out of the planet. A child born here in the U.S., will consume up to 16 times the amount of fossil fuels during the course of his or her lifetime as a kid born in India.
So for me, I don't want to bring another life into the world and add to the problem that we're already having, because people really are the problem.
I just wanted to begin in a prayer, whether it's recorded or not.
Keenan and Brianna Fitzpatrick are a Catholic couple in their mid-20s. I met with them at their church, St. Thomas, in Boulder, Colorado.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Brianna sits next to her husband,
Heavenly
head
Father,
bowed, hands clasped gently over her round belly.
First trimester was definitely very difficult. I remember at the very beginning, I was like, I don't know how women do this more than once, just because of like how I was feeling.
Keenan and Brianna are expecting their first child. They live on an organic farm outside Boulder. They get climate change, and they acknowledge that humans have contributed to the problem. But they told me they plan to have as many children as God gives them, and that maybe their children will be part of the solution.
What if baby Fitz, because we don't know the gender, what if baby Fitz will be the inventor of a completely green and sustainable factory.
What would you say to people who have made the decision not to have kids at all because of their environmental concerns?
In my mind, anytime there's a problem, I'm always like, okay, how do we figure out a solution? What if every person chose not to have children? Like, just because of environmental issues, is that a reason to stop life as a whole? In my mind, no.
And I think it comes down to fear. You know, there's a common Bible verse that says perfect love will cast out all fear. Easier said than done. But I can look back in my life and say that every decision I've made out of fear has not been a good one.
Keenan and Brianna don't see a conflict between caring for the earth and having kids. But for Mary and Travis, that conflict is big enough to make the decision against kids.
My research led me to the rather startling fact that about every 4 days, I think it's every 4.2 days, we add 1 million more people to the planet. And that's not a sustainable figure. There's just no way that we can keep doing that.
Alan Weissman is the author of two books about how our growing population affects the planet. Both books contain dire warnings. Yet he also believes that having a kid can be an environmentally friendly choice. And here's why.
If we started tomorrow, just having one child per family, we would continue to grow for about a generation, and then we would peak and then drop dramatically.
Sounds pretty simple, but what Weissman is saying here is kind of huge. If each family only had one kid, he says we'd have a shot at turning this population growth train around and bringing our numbers into balance with what the planet can sustain. There are more than 1 million babies born each week. Some models predict the global population will hit 11 billion by the end of the century. And that's a number that scientists say the planet just can't handle. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern.
And Ashley's story comes to us from KUOW's new environment podcast, Terrestrial. For more on that, go to hereandnow.org.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
The White House is calling this Made in America Week. Yesterday, President Trump spoke at a White House event showcasing a front-end loader made in Illinois and cowboy hats from Texas, among other products.
We want to build, create, and grow more products in our country using American labor, American goods, and American grit. When we purchase products made in the USA, the profits stay here, the revenue stays here, and the jobs, maybe most importantly of all, they stay right here in the USA.
Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, welcome back.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
And we should point out right at the top, I'm sure some people are thinking this as they heard President Trump say that, that a lot of his products and his daughter Ivanka Trump's products are not made in the United States.
Yeah, and that has come to the fore in the last few days. In fact, zero of Ivanka Trump's branded products are made in the United States, something that the person who's now heading her company says they are going to look at. And a very small proportion of Trump-branded products are made in the United States. Like a lot of low-value goods, that sort of stuff is not made here because it's cheaper to make it in other places. And that's how that's been part of the problem for the last few decades in the United States.
Have they offered any explanation about it? Or are they saying it's just cheaper to make it elsewhere?
Yeah. So Sean Spicer, asked about this yesterday, said made in America is not achievable for a lot of industries because companies go elsewhere to find better prices for manufacturing. That is the point. That is a hard circle to square because Americans like very low, very low cost goods, but they want higher wages. So what you have to do is you have to end up sort of like Germany, in which you make higher value goods for higher value labor. The reason we make things in Bangladesh and Vietnam and China and Mexico and all of these other places is labor rates are much lower. So it seems that Donald Trump understands that for his own brand and for Ivanka's brands, they would just like everybody else in the country to do it differently.
Well, would Americans buy products that were made in the U.S. but cost more?
Well, if you look at the wages for the average worker roughly since about 1980, they have stagnated. So one of the things that's helped with that is while wages haven't gone up all that much, nor have costs. So, you get a better TV adjusted for inflation than you would have 20 years ago for the same money. And that's part of the deal, that people people can understand that there's been outsourcing. They don't make as much money, but at least they get to keep a handle on the cost of goods. If you have the price of goods go up and you don't have the price of wages go up, that's where the problem comes in. Now, what Donald Trump is hoping will happen is that we will make more things in America. They will be more expensive, but because there are more jobs for manufacturing, wages will go up. This has been an intractable problem for four decades, and just saying that you want it to be doesn't solve it.
And just in the few seconds we have left, have they said how they want to do any of those things?
No, there's been some implication that it's got to do with regulations that the Trump administration is going to do away with. Mm. This is not a regulatory matter. This is pure economics. We buy things that are made for lower wages in other countries.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thanks as always.
No problem.
So this month, we've been spending some time at the lake. It is, after all, National Lake Appreciation Month. You can check out our talk with people behind that move to preserve and protect lakes. Find out how you can participate by testing your own lake's water. We also talked about the best lakes in the U.S. and heard from a lot of you. Here's a little more of what listeners had to say.
This is Brandon Bach, and I'm calling from Olympia, Washington. And today, I want to share a little secret with you about the Squaw Lake chain outside of Medford, Oregon, my favorite place to camp. It takes hours to get there on a dusty road that you think will never end, and typically temperatures are well over 100 degrees. But the hike and camping is second to none. Rocky bluffs where your tent can literally perch, and if you feel the need, you can cliff dive in the morning right outside your tent door. There are rope swings that will send you so far into the stratosphere that you think you'll never hit the cold water below. But when you do, it'll take your breath away.
Hi, it's Elizabeth Heron calling from Coventry, Rhode Island, the Ocean State. But I'm calling about my favorite lake there. Johnson's Pond is a great place for water skiing, tubing, and all things water sports. And it's had a long history for my family, with multiple generations enjoying the family summer home on the lake. That's also enabled them to see how much things have changed over the decades. The loss of blissful summers of moms and kids hanging out together lakeside as most women went to work and the lake house became a weekend retreat or a daily home. Great memories, but a sense of sadness that our kids won't have the same summer-long experience that their parents and grandparents had. But it's still a great place to watch the next generation learn how to water ski.
And Elizabeth there hit on something we want to talk about today, the lake house. The fortunate few who have a summer place passed down through generations, sometimes the same moldy mattresses with blue and white ticking. One of my great regrets, an aunt I'd hardly met left my family a house on Tupper Lake in upstate New York. I remember one visit, my grandmother clutching the pots and pans she insisted on bringing. The most impossibly clean, cool water, thick forest shade. But Dad had some money problems, had to sell it for $6,000. I looked up Tupper Lake real estate. Oh, look, there's a house now for $3 million. But that's a problem with lake houses, as we'll hear. From the Ewing family of Spokane, Washington, they've had cabins on the shore of the nearby Newman Lake for over 80 years. We're joined by two generations now, Father Jim and his son Eric Ewing. Jim, Dad, you know how these cabins can appreciate. I understand you still have some paperwork from when your family acquired a lot on the shore of Newman Lake in 1934. How much did they pay?
$275.
Yes.
And they paid 7% interest on the
right,
loan.
Right. And I'm sure there's a higher price on it, but probably priceless for your family. Eric, would you say?
Absolutely.
Eric, why don't you describe it for us? What's it like?
The property itself, there's three lots, and there's six cabins on three lots. And the middle lot has four cabins built on it. And we're all related. We're all there's cousins, aunts, uncles, everybody. And it's just it's amazing. They're my lake family.
Yeah.
You know, in the realm of cousins, they might be 17th or 25th cousins. I really don't know. But on the weekends and during the summer, they're the lake family. We see them Memorial Day through Labor Day, and you know, we're all out there. We boat, and you know, we have a floating dock out in the middle of the bay where we play King of the Dock, and that's what I grew up doing. And now my kids are almost overtaking me at King of the Dock, and it's just it's amazing.
As I'm sure you overtook your dad, Jim Ewing. Again, you have this original legal document showing this sale to four couples. One, your grandparents, James and Florence Wilbert, the parents of your mother, Wanda. Did you really understand when you were growing up what this could be, that it could be a decades, generation-long investment?
I really did. I knew it would just go on for a long time. The closely knit group, everybody got along good. Like I say, there was no doubt in my mind it would go on for generations.
But we're reading about so many other families who run into trouble, because especially when you share it with relatives— and either of you chime in, you know, at some point there might be a relative who needs to sell or who wants to sell as the land appreciates. I'm sure around you people are building very grand lake homes, which raises your taxes.
Robin, that's correct, and you're absolutely spot on. In our bay there are probably, 12 lots, and three or four of those older cabins have been purchased and demolished, and homes in the area of probably easily $500,000 or $600,000 have been built. So, because the value of some of the other lots, the value of the homes on them and the prices they're willing to pay for the lots has increased the value of our lots, which is good to a point, but that affects the taxes, and we're trying to, keep them down so that the family members can afford to keep the cabins and not be forced into selling them.
I'm reading about over in Lake Coeur d'Alene where some of the taxes up, $12,000. And this is a seasonal cabin.
That's a very popular lake. And, we're having retired football players and actresses and actors buying homes there. And It's a vacation paradise there, and it's probably increasing in value faster than our cabins at Newman Lake.
Yeah. Well, and again, the pressure is on families who've had it for generations to sell, either because they can't afford the taxes or they can't resist what they might get for the land. And, Eric, what are they losing? What has this done? You have four sons, you mentioned. What has this done to have this retreat?
You know, for me, I think the one thing that really stands out is there's no other place that I would rather enjoy the calm and the chaos that can be the lake with kids. You know, I remember when I was a kid, it was from the time in the morning that we got up. I was waiting for my cousins to get up, and we would play until our parents made us go to bed. And that's how my kids are now. And sometimes it seems a little chaotic, but there's no better place for it.
Yeah.
And then the calmness, the lake in the morning, when I get up before the kids and the lake is just a sheet of glass and it's very peaceful. It's just, it's amazing.
Yeah. And at night when there's that quiet and then the peepers, that's it. Jim, what do you do? What have you done on the lake? Lake memories?
Well, I'm going to go back a little ways. When my mother was probably back in the early 1940s or late 30s, she was well into her teens, and there were two dance halls on the lake built out over the water. And she would tell, on a Saturday night, they would be all lit up with live bands playing music, and you could hear the two dance halls were across the lake from one another, and she said you could hear the music clear across the lake. And she said the rowboats were just going back and forth. The boys were checking out the girls across the lake at the dance hall. And if the parents were at one dance hall, the teenagers would row over to the other one, that type of thing. And I can remember basically in my early life those dance halls. They were getting pretty decrepit and eventually were torn down. But I know that was a highlight back then.
Oh, my God. It's like a scrapbook with water. I don't know what the answer to this is, but do you Ewings consider yourselves wealthy?
wife and I are both retired and, you know, not wealthy, but, you know, comfortable.
I tell people in my business, I time races and so running races and triathlons and stuff. And, you know, I'm not getting rich doing that, but my wealthy is getting to spend, you know, Wednesday through Thursday or whatever at the lake with my kids. Yeah. There's a radio commercial for North Idaho, playing North Idaho, that runs on our radios, and it says you only get 18 summers with your kids. And so, you know, I really try to make the most of that. And we're super lucky to have the lake places to take advantage of that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You are not wealthy, but you are rich in, you know, having this this spot. Thank you, James and Florence Wilbert, I'm sure you say.
absolutely. They were the inspiration.
Well, thank you so much. Jim and Eric Ewing, talking about the lake house they've had for generations now on Newman Lake outside Spokane, Washington. Thank you.
Robin, thank you.
China is already a big economic investor in Africa. Now Beijing is setting up its first ever overseas military base on the continent. It's in the Horn of Africa, in the tiny country of Djibouti. Joining us now, BBC Africa security correspondent Tommy Alapido. He's in Nairobi. Tommy, why is China doing this?
Well, if you follow what China's been doing around the world, especially in Africa, there's a lot of investment going on, billions of dollars of Chinese money going in to different projects across Africa, and thousands, if not millions, of Chinese people around Africa. So I think China feels now it needs to be able to protect its interests and protect its people. There have been cases, for example, when fighting broke out in Libya in 2011, and not too long ago in South Sudan when fighting broke out there as well, China had to evacuate its citizens. So I think it feels now it needs to be much closer to its interests on the ground.
And why put the base in Djibouti?
Well, Djibouti is a country that has attracted a lot of foreign militaries. There are already bases there belonging to the U.S., of course, the largest U.S. permanent military base in Africa, as well as the Japanese and the French also have a presence there. So Djibouti is strategically located at the Horn of Africa along the Gulf of Aden. It's a busy shipping route. It's an area where not far from where Somali pirates have operated and have targeted merchant ships. But Djibouti is a peaceful enclave surrounded by a volatile area. So you've got Somalia next door, you've got Yemen across the Red Sea, and it's just a place where a lot of foreign militaries feel they can operate and easily access some of these trouble spots.
Well, and you mentioned that the U.S. has a base there in Djibouti. Is China challenging the United States by doing this?
China insists it's not doing this. It's not challenging the U.S. or anybody else. It says this is not for military expansion. But I think it's important to note that China being a rival, this is going to cause some uncomfortable scenarios for everybody who's there. The countries who are there, you've got US, Japan, France, who are already sort of allies, and China, who's from the other side, who's considered a rival, steps in. That's going to cause some discomfort for these people, and that's why there is that kind of a response. But Djibouti, as the host, seems to be happy to have everybody. It's having the income coming from the rent, and it's also having a safe space for its investments as a small country. So I think Djibouti has no problem with having all these people around.
And Djibouti, by the way, has a new railway right now that connects it to the capital of Ethiopia, also paid for by China, right?
Yes, indeed. Ethiopia is one of the largest economies in the region, and it's landlocked. Djibouti lies just by the water, by the sea there, and Ethiopia needs access to the port. So it sort of works well for the Ethiopians that there's this railway that crosses from their capital, Addis Ababa, to Djibouti, and this is funded by the Chinese, and the Chinese have pretty much funded almost every major project around Africa. If you go across the continent, airports, highways, bridges, all these kinds of mega projects are funded by the Chinese.
Is there any skepticism by the people there in Africa about all of this Chinese investment? Do they think that they're getting a good deal out of it or not?
I don't think we'd call it skepticism. It's a bit of cautious optimism, because for a long time, African countries depended on the West, the US, the UK, the IMF, World Bank, and all these major Western-affiliated organizations. But when the money came, it came with strings attached, and they were told how to spend the money. But now with the Chinese, there's a sense that there's a bit more freedom. And there's actually work being done. So if you see across a lot of African countries, there's been the speed of development has sort of gone up recently because the Chinese are coming in, they're getting involved, they're not asking too many questions about how the money is going to be spent, and things are being done. So Africans actually are warming up to the Chinese more than they did to the West in terms of these kinds of projects.
What kind of investment is the U.S. doing in that region of Africa right now?
Well, that's a difficult one because, you know, for a long time, the U.S. has been involved with PEPFAR, for example, health-related investments, helping African governments and also providing support in terms of military and intelligence. But with the new administration, we haven't seen any sort of deliberate change of plan or boosting of American involvement here. So if anything, things appear to be more quiet than they were before. But at the same time, we do know that with the humanitarian crises going on across Africa, we've got the Boko Haram crisis in the Lake Chad Basin, we've got the Somali conflict, as well as with South Sudan. The U.S. has been involved in terms of providing both military and humanitarian support. So more in that regard and less in terms of the actual, you know, on-the-ground investment when it comes to major infrastructure mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
That's the BBC's Africa security correspondent, Tommy Oladipo, joining us from Nairobi. Tommy, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.